Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest a person whose career I've been following practically from the first, and she's been on the show from the time the show began. It's Eileen Miles, and she has gone through all of the stages of being a poet. That is to say, she's published early books of poetry, she's published short stories, she's published a novel, she's published travel writing. She has now been asked by the Yale University Press to participate in their series, Why I Write, which has also included books by Patti Smith and Nausgaard and Chip Delaney. It's a fabulous thing to have Eileen Miles writing about why I write in a wonderful short book from Yale University Press called For Now. And what did you think of when you were asked to say why you write?
Oh, God, I thought, oh, no. Just the thought of writing something and talking about what you're doing. Well, I mean, in a way, it's the essence of what I do. But the good news was that I had this other problem, which was my apartment in New York, which I was almost on the verge of losing. So the two intertwined, and that became a bait and switch, which made me very happy, and it lightened the load.
You had been living in this apartment for 42 years before you got an eviction notice. Am I remembering?
It's exactly true, yeah.
I was given a recognition by the wonderful literary magazine Public Space. They asked people to write tributes to my show and my voice. I didn't know who they were asking, but there's one, and it's my very favorite one, by Eileen Miles, my guest, and I'm going to read it to you because it made me incredibly happy. Here we go. First, let me start with Michael's voice, and immediately I go visual. He's like a big cat. I think of the enormous floating black cat in Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. Michael's voice and perspective on literature and books is magical, and not something you can or would want to pin down. I can never predict his enthusiasm and where his excitement will land. So he's a bird and cat, too. His criticism purrs and sings. His friendship, and honestly, that is how it feels to be in the studio with him, warm and more than a little bit chosen. Plus, I have known Michael before he was Michael, having met him in the LA poetry world circa 1982-ish, and he was the same then, but without the wonderful hat, which is his entire adult career, where he has manifested the thinking cat. Books fling themselves into our consciousness every season, every year. As a writer, lots of books land on my shore from friends and total strangers. Picture the beach of literature that surrounds this man, this kind of elegant beachcomber, the best kind of bum. I feel so grateful to have been picked up time and again and seen. I say friends because we are friends, but I say it more widely because friend is the ideal word for the engaged, weird, and loving reader who meets the particularity of the work and sings it with all he's got. Michael's a crooner and my kind of man. Love you, dude. Now, Eileen, I never got the chance to thank you for that, and I want to tell you how thrilled I was to have you say something about me. I love it still. Thank you.
Thank you. I stand by this message.
Now, part of the time, at least, you're living in Marfa, Texas, which is an art town where you were brought for the first month by the Lannan Foundation, who are, in turn, the sponsors of my show Bookworm. So Eileen, Miles, and I have an enormous amount of existence in common. Tell me about Marfa, Texas.
You know, I love it. Every time I get here from New York, I think, where the hell am I? And then it starts to come down because it's an enormous space. It's a big sky. It's a quiet place, largely. And there's just enough culture to like balance the two in this weirdly exquisite way. You know, and I fell in love with it because it has nothing to do with me. I'm East Coast, I'm New York, I'm New England. This is not my landscape. And so the first time I came here, I thought, wow, I can really work here because it just had nothing identificatory. It was like a big open notebook with these big blue mountains. So I very quickly bought a house after the month I spent here. I bought a house at that moment just before a market becomes a market. So I really kind of scored. And then I brought my dog here, who mostly lives here. It's like my house and to some extent is a dog house.
Well, if you want to know about a poet's life, the book to read is Eileen Miles's new book from Yale University Press called For Now. She has always written in the moment, and she comments that her voice has changed depending on where she's writing. So when she's lived in England, she speaks English. When she lives in Marfa, Texas, have you spoken Texan? Is your work now Texan? Do you draw?
I don't draw, but I think what I do is I feel very relaxed into my own vernacular because that's what's here. And I don't have to try so hard. In New York, I think it's like it's always a patois, whatever we speak in a given place. And you bring where you came from in a way, and then you hear what they're doing and you add on. So I'm not going to ever become Texan, but I think there's a way in which you simply relax into the setting.
Well, the Yale people have you coming in order to speak this book as addressing the Wyndham Campbell Prizes. They are quite extraordinary. Like you, I went to hear Donald Wyndham read for Tim Dugos at the Ear Inn. I was there too. This book is addressed to prize winners, but Eileen Miles deserves a literary prize. She has been working for as long as any poet I know, more surprisingly, more emphatically, more sexually, and as she was saying, she invents her own patois as she goes. This book is written in what I hope you will permit me, Eileen, to call Eileen syntax. It's beautiful. It's not to be found anywhere else. How do you do it? How do you make these sentences that are unlike anyone else's sentences, both in your poetry and in your fiction and in this literary prose? Can you say how you do it?
I think it's compensatory. I mean, I think I came to New York and I felt like I was arriving with a handicap. You know, I came from Boston. I didn't go to a college where anybody I knew was going to be in New York. I was very aware that I was working class, but it was a moment in which, you know, people like Patty, people like Bruce Springsteen, like working class was okay, but you had to be that. And I also felt very self-conscious about being a poet. And so I thought if I sounded like me, people wouldn't accuse me of somehow putting a crown on my head that I hadn't earned. I thought I'm just being myself here, you know? And so I brought in, you know, a working class English that even in itself, I mean, my mother was Polish, was a first generation. She was the child of Polish immigrants. Her first language had been Polish. And so I think she was very aware of like proper English and always making sure that we didn't speak to working class East. But I always thought, you know, the kids next door were cool. And they were like Tom Sawyer. You know, the rhythms of your home are the rhythms of your writing voice. I think that's just always true. Like when I read in a Boston accent. There's no hope.
Well, there's nothing like your Boston accent. I think that you bring the accent to poetry and to your prose. And I love hearing you read because there is that extraordinary vowel noise that you, and you now go by the pronoun they and them, they bring the Boston accent, the Boston vowel, to the word art. Say art for me.
Art. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to, when I think about it, it's hard to do it, but it's art, you know? And I went to Cambridge there's a poetry library at Cambridge. I'm blanking on the Woodbury Library that Christina Davis runs. And I went there. I was in Boston for a month and I was writing about Boston and I got a fellowship from this library. And what I pitched to them was that I was going to write about poets with Boston accents, you know, and look in their recordings. And there weren't many. It was kind of interesting. But what I did learn is there's such a thing as the non-riotic R. And it's a rustic 18th century accent. I mean, it's really about who came to Boston in the 18th century and the accent stayed. And interestingly, the only place that has the same R is Australia. So Australia is the only place where I've gone to read that nobody has said, you're from Boston, because they can't hear my accent.
You know, I think, Eileen, that you read more than anyone beside me. Does your reading influence your voice?
You mean in the writing?
In the writing, yes.
Well, I think I've always experienced writing as an act of listening. You know, I think in a way when I began, when I started writing poems when I was young, I felt like I might be going nuts. And I just felt there was a murmuring and I felt I had a sense of dictation. Like it didn't entirely seem like my intelligence or me as I knew myself. And I even feared I was going crazy. And so I think, and also when I came to New York, I had no idea how to get published. But what there was then and still now was just a very lively reading scene. And so I was, you know, very in love with Joni Mitchell and that whole realm of singer-songwriters. And so I remember Joni Mitchell having the line, she tapes her regrets to the microphone stand. And I thought that I was being a singer going out with my little sheaf of poems every night in New York and doing readings. And reading seems like the truest realization of the work. I feel very excited when a poem is new. The first time I read it publicly is just such a good feeling because you're really sharing the experience of writing the poem with other people.
Well, you have been the poet, teacher, dare I say lesbian, for a whole generation of poets who have learned from Eileen Miles. Just about every young poet I've cared about, I've also heard read with Eileen somewhere or another, including Ariana Rines. Almost all the new generation of women poets have had an influence from Eileen Miles. Since you came, as if I remember the title of the first book, A Fresh Young Voice from the Plain, or maybe that was The Irony of the Leash, that's the first one. But after that, came A Fresh Young Voice from the Plains. What is it like to go around the country meeting the people who've been influenced by Eileen Miles?
You know, I think maybe in the 90s was the first time when I went on tour with Sister Spit. I felt like I met my audience for the first time. I was in my 40s and suddenly there were all these girls in their 20s who knew my work. And it was great. It was like I felt like I was you know, I was suddenly not so out of time. You know, I mean, my work was always well received. I was always in the poetry scene, but it was, you know, it was like a very, you know, New York can be very local. And so my readership was as wide as my friendship world was. But when I got out there with Sister Spit and realized that I had been received by the next generation, I felt like in a way I was meeting my generation for the first time, you know? And it's funny now when I do readings, if I see a bunch of people, I'm 71, if I see a bunch of people my age in the audience, I think, where's my audience? Where are my people? You know, because I've really gotten used to, I've gotten used to people thinking, it's like looking in the mirror and being shocked by your face. You know, you're like, wait a second, that's not me.
When I was at Skylight Books, I believe when your selected poems came out, the place was so crowded. It was so full that we, you know, it reminded me of some of the readings that Allen Ginsberg gave when everyone was present. Everyone wanted to be there. And he was one of your friends and influences, yes?
He was really generous and, you know, really just walked up to me when I was 25 at a reading and was like, who are you? You know, and really very much took me into the family and you know, supported my work and stuff. And I, you know, and he made a model for, Alan was kind of addicted to being out there. And I've been trying to have a rhythm for myself, and living in Montfort is part of that, of a rhythm of pulling away and being out there. But he was definitely a model of generosity and being really interested in younger writers. And, you know, he at the New Year's benefit at St. Mark's, he would just sit there on the floor till the absolute end. He heard everyone, you know, and I think that, you know, again, I think it's a listening practice, poetry. And I think you need to do that, you know, and it's kind of how we stay alive.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Eileen Miles about their new book, For Now. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Eileen Miles about their new book, For Now, which explores the writerly process of finding a perspective for loving the world in the time of your existence. Now, you mentioned the generosity of Allen Ginsberg, but I know personally so many poets who met you for the very first night and experienced your generosity with great lapping excitement. You know, how do you behave as a generous poet?
I like doing what I do. I mean, I think there's that. I feel if it's generous to be actually very happy that you're doing exactly what you do. You know, I remember, you know, being younger and finding older poets were kind of bitter, you know, and I think there were probably expectations that this is supposed to happen and that's supposed to happen. And, you know, and if these things don't happen, then I've got to, you know, get a job and have some kind of, and I've kind of done it my own way, which was not always comfortable. So I don't think I come to it with a whole lot of bitterness.
My young friend and someone I care about so much that I treat him like a son, Alan Felsenthal, met you when you were visiting Iowa. He went out to dinner with you and several others, and he called me up to tell me how great Eileen Miles is, Eileen Miles, who he had never met before, Eileen Miles, who in the course of the dinner found out who everyone was and found a way to speak to each person individually, much as the way, in the way that you detect my absolute relative friendship with the cat in The Master and Margarita. You're one of the geniuses of friendship, Eileen. When I read your selected poems, I said, this is a memoir of friendship. I mean, and it was beautiful. So is one of my very favorite books of yours. You call it travel essays. I don't know what to call it. The Importance of Being Iceland is a fabulous book, and so is Chelsea Girls. You have monumental works that invite anyone who reads them to know you and to be your friend. You ran for president even at one point. You look around and there's Eileen Miles front and center doing her thing without making people furious at your extraordinary quality of personhood.
A career is sort of an ongoing, to me, an ongoing communal gesture. And it's like, I feel like a person who's really torn between my desire to be completely alone and really loving that. And then this need to be in the collective that kind of I'm born from, you know, I mean, I came to New York with a BA in English. And at that moment, St. Mark's Poetry Project had, you know, free writing workshops. So there was a very porous, publicly funded art world that I entered into. And, you know, within a year, I was at a party at Allen Ginsberg's house and Robert Lowell was there. And it just seemed like it was all there and it was all open. And I just think I want the world to continue to be the place that I entered, because I feel like I was lucky and I do have some talent and I have some energy. And I think I want to keep reflecting a world that welcomed me.
Well, one of the beautiful things you say in For Now, when you're talking about them trying to evict you from your rent-controlled apartment of 42 years, how dare they take away the apartment of the most famous poet in the East Village? You say that there are three, and that when you leave, there'll be two. But actually, you came, you settled in the East Village, you became, if I remember correctly, the director of the St. Mark's Poetry Project. So many people owe their beginnings in life to you. Then, amazingly, you talk about it here in For Now as well, you became the head of the poetry department at UCSD, the University of San Diego. You said, I'm not just teaching them how to write poetry. I'm teaching them how to get their poetry into the world. I'm teaching them how to go to bookstores and get funding for the poetry. It's not just writing poetry, it's being a poet in the world, which is one of the things that For Now is ultimately about. And it's very beautiful in its strange way that Yale University Press invites you to speak to a group of prize winners, among whom Eileen Miles ought to be named, but instead, you're the person who can talk about why I write and what it's like to write to the present moment. Do you still believe as strongly in the present?
Yeah. Though I have to admit my sense of time has changed radically, as I think all of ours has. You know, it's such an atomized present. And it seemed a very strange mix of public and private. But I think, again, it's just like that is the thing we have to, I have to instrumentalize within it. Like I'm working on a big novel right now, and hopefully it'll be out in a few years. And it's just like this pandemic has totally changed the shape of that novel, because I know the kinds of things I'm writing have everything to do with this kind of collective shut-in quality. And, you know, it just lends me towards fantasy and history. So the present is different again.
Can you tell me, do you have a proposed name for this novel?
I do. It's called All My Loves. It sounds like a soap opera.
That's great.
I mean, originally the idea was it would be bits and pieces of domesticity. Like I realized that when you write about love or relationships, you don't write about the strange habits that each person had in the kitchen and how you, as a single person, march along in all those kitchens somehow psychologically. Like there's an architecture of love and relationships. So that was the beginning. But then I just realized when I decided I wanted to write a 1,000-page book, I decided that it had to talk about many other kinds of love. I bring in and will bring in other texts. For instance, I think we really had to work to get Yale to agree to let parts of this book go into another book. And because part, like when I write about the box that I lost of manuscripts here, like I always intended to put that in my novel. And so Yale essentially gave me permission to use those parts because it's going to be very constructed out of, you know, new materials and then pieces of stray pieces from here and there. You know, like I talk about the kind of plucky orphans of writing that just keep wanting to be in another book.
Well, this book, All My Love, sounds like your destiny. I'm so thrilled to hear you're writing a 1,000-page novel, Eileen, but I know it's going to be a 1,000-page poem, too. I've been talking with Eileen Miles, author of For Now. It's published by Yale University Press in their series, Why I Write. Thank you, Eileen, for joining me.
Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, I love you. I can't explain, but it seems like we've been friends from the very beginning of our separate histories, and it's always a pleasure. And believe me, despite how strange it sounds, an honor to talk to you. I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping from our respective residences. Eileen right now is in Marfa, Texas. I'm in my apartment in Los Angeles, so pardon us if you hear unusual sounds. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. You can hear all of the interviews I've done over the years with Eileen Miles. Anything can be listened to on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my Bookworm Show collaborators, my dear Alan Howard, who is the editor, and Sean Sullivan, who makes really the show possible. Our engineer today is Paul Smith, and acting technical director is PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.